after. This is recorded on the afternoon of July the 29th, 1970, at 2001 Union Street, Lafayette, Indiana. The interview is between Professor Richard Cordell, Professor George Ade, Professor Emeritus, English Department, Purdue University, and R.B. Eccles Department of History. This is recorded for the Purdue University Archives. Professor Cordell, let's start out with the obvious question. Where were you born? Where were you educated? And well, take us up to the time that you first came to Purdue and why you came to Purdue.
I was born in Bloomington, Indiana, and went to the high school there and to the university for my undergraduate work. And I did my graduate work at the University of London.
Would you give us some dates? When did you get your B.A.?
I got my B.A. in 1917.
Right at the end of the war, or right while the war was
yes.
on. Were you in the Army?
I had a short Army experience. I taught 1 year in high school, and then at the end of the year...
Where'd you teach in high school?
A little town called Smithville, south of Bloomington. And then I went into the Army in 1918, was in the Army, and the armistice came. And I had a strange experience there. I saw on the bulletin board at officers' training camp, Camp Taylor, a request for someone with a knowledge of French to give some French lessons to quartermaster officers going overseas. It was very simple French. I applied for it and got the job. How to buy, how to sell, how to rent a house, and so on. My superior officer, who knew nothing of a foreign language, was so impressed by that that he knew someone at Purdue and wrote a letter recommending me for the French department at Purdue. And after the armistice, I came up here, accepted a job to teach French, for which I was not qualified. I'd taken some courses for fun in college, enjoyed it. And I did teach one French class in high school, along with German and algebra, one or two other things. But before the first class in the started the semester, the president called me into the office, asked me if I could mind teaching English instead.
This was President who?
President Stone.
And he called you, an instructor, into the
yes.
office to arrange the schedule.
Yes.
Purdue was indeed a very small school.
Yes, it was very simple. That's one of the interesting things as we look back on the old days. When I first came here, I was invited to the president's home, just a young instructor to be, and we had tea and we talked over the appointment. It's just unthinkable today, of course. Those were the simple days. If a head of a department wanted a new typewriter, he got an appointment with the president, went to his office, and they talked it over. One departmental head told me he wanted screens for the first floor of his building. Flies were very bad. No air conditioning or anything, of course. And they talked it over 2 hours, and finally President Stone said, "We just don't have enough in the budget for screens." Imagine a modern college president giving 2 hours to a topic like that.
What was a campus like then?
What do you mean, physically or the life?
Well, what was the life on the campus?
Well, it was seems that there was perhaps too much law and order then, and enrollment was small, and most who went, there were about 4,000 students, I think, when I came here. Most of them, I think, felt so glad to get to college. It was a real privilege, and it never occurred to them to do more than grumble. I was, of course, human for students to grumble about things and so on. But relatively quiet. The good deal of practical joking among the students and raiding the theaters after a football victory and fairly harmless things.
Taking
like that.
The wire off the trolley.
Oh, yes.
You did have trolley cars then.
Trolley cars. And also they had a jitney service for 5 cents. You could come from the alongside the courthouse to the university. And it was in competition with the 5 cent streetcar fare at that time.
How many men were in the English department when you
there
first
were 10 came? Men, 10 people in the English department. The head of the department was a charming, kind, extremely likable person, and it's an understatement to say that he was continuously in his office. He liked golf and bridge, and was often very hard to find for days at a time. Abe Martin said 60 years ago, a feller broke his leg Thursday afternoon and had to drag himself all the way to the golf course to have it set. But
who was the head? Was that Ayers?
No. Edward Ayers.
Edward Ayers.
The most charming person. And he died within a year after I came here. The department was run very casually, as you could imagine. There were no guidelines. I don't think there was a mimeograph machine in a mile of University Hall. We were handed textbooks and said, go to it. And that's about all.
Did you teach literature there?
No.
Or was your work concentrated on composition and comma splicing?
The first 2 years I was here, I taught 6 classes of composition, each meeting 3 times a week, over 200 students. And each one wrote a theme a week. But I did not know that I was being abused. My only other teaching experience had been in high school, and I had taught 4 subjects, including mathematics and German and French, and done some coaching. I was busy all day, every day, so I didn't think there was anything particularly unusual about it then. After Dr. Creek came in 1921, he saw to it that every member of the department got at least one class in literature. No smoking was permitted on the campus at all when I came here.
Was that for health or moral reasons?
I think moral.
In other words, a man who smoked was not fit to instruct undergraduates.
The violation of the rules, you could well guess, was mostly made by the staff and not by the students.
Then, of course, the attitude towards the recently enacted Volstead Act and the prohibition was that anyone who drank was obviously uncivilized, barbaric,
right,
and not fit to instruct students.
Monthly paychecks had to be picked up at the bursar's office then in University Hall. And we were notified the day where they would be there, and we had to go individually. Each one got his own check. If he failed to come on that day, he had to wait another month. I could never see any reason for that. It seemed just sadistic somewhere.
Well, don't you think that promptness and attentiveness showed is demonstrated there? This seems to me be in line with a university that would allow no smoking or no drinking among the staff. Indeed, it was a Calvinist kind institution, wasn't it?
One result of it was a good one. I rarely have had any discipline problem all my years at Purdue, although I had one the very first year. There was a student in my class, the son of a head of the department. He was not just mischievous, he was cruel in the practical jokes he played. And I could not control him. I couldn't find the head of the department, so I went to the president. And I told him my story. And President Stone said, just remember, at Purdue, you do not need to have anyone in your class who is not a gentleman. That gave me all the courage I needed. And the next day, he was punching a Chinese student in front of him with a pen and hurting the boy. And I said, Mr. So-and-so, will you please gather up your books, leave the class, I'd never come back. He looked at me astonished, and there was great silence in the class. I just stood there and looked at him. Finally, he gathered his books, went shuffling out of the room, slammed the door. Later that day, the dean of men called me and said, "Did you tell so-and-so to leave your class and never come back?" I said, "Yes, I did," trembling a little. He said, "Good for you. It should have been done long ago." But I rarely had any problem like that.
As a matter of fact, Purdue students were, on the whole, receptive eager to learn and pretty healthy.
That's right.
Now, how long did you continue with this noble task of composition?
Well, the workload was gradually reduced through the years to the conventional 12 hours.
You retire as George 8 professor with a 12-hour load?
No. And I was made distinguished professor in 1959. I was given complete freedom. And I could teach as much as I wished or devote as much time to research.
You were in the first group to be made a distinguished professor, weren't you?
And I chose to teach 9 hours. I could have taught only six, but I wanted my two elective courses, and I also wanted one course of freshman. Most of my colleagues thought me insane for deliberately taking on a freshman course, but I wanted it. I had the two courses of advanced.
There are many universities who believe that the professors should teach the freshmen and the assistant professors the advanced courses.
One hears that over and over, and it gives a little sense to it. Incidentally, the deans, when I came here, had very plebeian names, purely by accident, coincidence, but we had Dean Skinner, Dean Shoemaker, Dean Potter, Dean Fisher, and even Dean Coulter. I think Coulter is a part of the plow.
Now, Coulter was your immediate dean, wasn't he?
Yes, and also dean of men at one time. Mm-hmm. He was dean of what is called then the science school.
Now, he's the man after who the Stanley Coulter Hall was
named.
That's right. Yes, all right.
The deans were extremely powerful then, and often really autocratic. For example, I know that the dean of one school would take the budget proposal brought in by a department head, take his pencil, make changes without any consultation. It's merely announced, we'll give him $100 less next year and this one $100 more, and go right through without any consultation, really. And the deans had almost the last word on promotions before they had good committees and faculty participation, at least in suggesting promotions and so on.
Were a lot of committees, you think, necessary when you worked with so few people and knew everyone so well? My guess is you probably knew everybody in the school of science, didn't you?
Yeah, practically. they weren't nearly in proportion to the number of students. There were as many committees then as now. The duties of the dean of, I think they don't even use the words now, deans, but the duties of the dean of men, the dean of women then, were largely disciplinary in nature. When a student was summoned to the office of the dean of men, there was no dialogue, there was no dissent. The dean spoke, the student obeyed, and there was no demonstration. Sometimes he just went home, sometimes he was chastened, went back, behaved himself or tried to. But don't get the wrong impression. The Dean Fisher and Coulter and Shoemaker were kind, humane people. Though their rigid Victorian morality would probably provoke violence among
modern
students.
I've heard alumni of the period of the 20s discuss the campus morals, and it seemed to me that they're average and healthy. Young men pursued young women, as young men have always pursued young women. And sometimes there were professional facilities available for more intimate contact and across the town, across the river.
More than now, probably.
Well, I'm told amateur competition is.
They found out the same thing about studies have been made of the daily life of the Puritans in New England, that the incidence of sexual and other immorality is about as high there as in the more permissive and carefree South. I'd like to add here that in spite of the peace and quiet and the law and order and other romantic qualities we apply to the past, Purdue was not a first-rate university. Its first interest was in training engineers, farmers, homemakers, and pharmacists, not in educating young men and a few women so that they could then become professional people, educated as well as trained. Departments such as English, history, foreign languages were tolerated, viewed generally with some condescension, and called service departments. They are allowed to operate just as far as necessary for Purdue to get its required accreditation.
Let me be perfectly clear then, because I've heard this from, I've heard a different slant from other people. May I then interrupt you and say that these other people say certainly this is true, because Purdue was thought of and has always been a land-grant university, and that as a land-grant university it must teach mechanical arts and applied science. Thus the so-called luxuries of history and literature and sociology are unnecessary. Were you aware of this in these early days?
Oh,
is this the reason that you...
Oh yes, I was quite aware.
They're still talking about it today.
Oh yes, it's... in fact, there's been a revival, strengthening of that old point of view in the past two or three years.
Then, Louis, would you agree with Professor Louis M. Sears, late of the Department of History, that the work done in the humanities was almost pure missionary work?
Well, that's a humorous way of putting it, yes. However, in the mid-1920s, slight change became apparent. A few men, such as Professor Estee, head of the Department of Economics and History, a strange academic marriage for sure, and Professor Creek, head of the English Department, considered a university as something more than a job training institute, and education as much more than preparation for job holding. They introduced a great heresy at Purdue that learning, a better word than the juiceless term education, in a university should prepare oneself for a good life, not merely for making a good living. These few, I won't call them idealists, for they had a more sensible view of the entire man and the chance to lead an exciting, stimulating, and productive life than did the job trainers. They were voices for a while crying in the wilderness. But changes occurred. Certain manual courses in engineering, little more than blacksmithing, were dropped. Interest spread from experimental science to include the history of science and its sociological and other implications. A vigorous department of philosophy got underway.
Now this was really, was this before or after World War II?
This was after World War II.
In other words, we're talking about the sweep from the 1920s to the 1960s.
That's right.
Go ahead.
I heard President Eliot say several times he wanted to get a professor of philosophy here, but he could never find one. It was not until after the Second World War that the department was actually founded. And finally, as is well known, degrees, even advanced degrees, were offered in the humanities. But I think a sort of unhappy result has been a discouraging polarization. Requirements in the humanities are still determined by accreditation demands in some schools. An engineering professor told a large class in 1969, "We don't need any money from the Centennial Fund to go to a new library. We already have more books than students read. All this money should go for the Scientific Research Center." The two students who reported this to me said that as far as he could tell, practically all the other students agreed with the professor. This polarization is regrettable. More and more, schools of law and medicine are discovering that laws and physicians need to know a great deal more than law and medicine. In engineering, it is well known that graduates who have a command of the English language and an interest in and knowledge of people have a far better chance of advancing in their profession than do the others. It is ironical that before man got to the moon, Purdue regarded George Ade, Bruce Rogers, and John McCutcheon as its most distinguished graduates.
And will you identify these gentlemen?
Yes. George Ade was a playwright, writer of fables. Bruce Rogers was probably the world's most renowned printer and artist. John McCutcheon, of course, was a cartoonist for many years in Chicago, an artist too. It's the Chicago Tribune.
And not one of these men were preeminent in the field of science or technology.
In what was called then School of Science, although they were not scientifically trained. It's rather amusing to note that Purdue is the only United States university to name its football stadium after a playwright, an author of cynical fables. Could have been named after a famous bridge builder.
Well, the other name with it, the Ross Ade, is named after a trustee
yes.
and inventor of in mechanical arts.
He was inventor of a great many valuable things.
Chemical engineering.
President Hovde has admitted that his great disappointment, actually he used the word failure, at Purdue has been his inability to harness the social sciences and the vocational departments together successfully. One cannot say who is at fault. Certainly it isn't the president alone, or the professional schools alone, or the humanities and social sciences alone. But there's a danger now that Purdue will, in frustration, quit trying to be a really great university and recede in some ways to the technical institute level again, but a huge one, of course, this time. Perhaps such change is inevitable. I find it both significant and depressing that in the search for a new librarian, the university, a knowledge of computer science is considered more important than a love of books. You've gathered there's no continuity in my talk, no outline or plan. Here are some more odds and ends of information that I've recalled in the past day or two. I said there were 10 members of the English department when I started here. One of them taught all the courses in public speaking. There was no public speaking department, speech department. And one of the 10, Paul Sidwell, was also the university tennis coach.
Sidwell had gone to Princeton, hadn't he?
Yes.
Well, naturally, he would play tennis then.
Yes.
That was a gentleman's sport at Princeton
yes,
in those days.
And he played it very well, and he played it for many years after he was past the age when you think that people play tennis. In those days, all engineering students had to take at least 2 courses in English, and the freshmen were divided then into groups of mechanical, electrical, chemical, civil engineering students. They were separated. And there was always a tussle in the English and math department to get the classes of chemical engineering boys. They were better students in every way. The reason, the head of the chemical engineering school, Professor Peffer, interviewed every applicant to the chemical engineering school and effectively discouraged every mediocre student from entering. The result was amazing. And no wonder English and math instructors tried to get Pfeffer's boys. Later, of course, all freshman engineering students were lumped together. There used to be a late morning convocation at Fowler Hall every Wednesday when classes were shortened 10 minutes to provide the extra time. Excellent musicians were brought in from Chicago, the Cincinnati Conservatory of Music, and elsewhere, and Fowler Hall was crowded. But on alternate Wednesdays, there was a speaker. The crowds were understandably, perhaps properly, small. The administration was piqued by the poor attendance at these lectures and dropped the whole program, ignoring the fact that Fowler Hall was filled for the musical programs. It gave insufficient attendance as the reason for dropping the program.
And it was later revived when I helped set it up, in a sense then, for seniors in the School of Science under the guise of the Great Issues course.
Yes, well, they...
Of course, that was a little different.
Different quality of speaker who had something to say, usually very close to the students' interests, to the world they were about to get out into. I remember it cost more to tear down the old electrical engineering building, where the present chemistry building is, than it had cost to erect it. That rather astonished us at the time. Yet I have heard that reconstructing University Hall cost over 10 times as much as the original building cost. We've got rather inured to such things. In retrospect, it seems that the proportion of original characters was as great then as in our own permissive era. There was Professor Little, an internationally known Shakespearean scholar, who wore a cutaway coat and striped trousers to class. There was another real scholar who was head of the Physical Education School for Men, the division for men, who read Greek as a pastime. One of his successors pronounced at faculty meetings the name of his school as Physical Education. There was a head of one school who chewed tobacco in his office, mistakenly believing he concealed this fact from the students who came in for conference. There was a dean of women who counseled the girls never to wear red dresses, and who was a student loan organization herself. Some of the money she lent to the girls was never paid back, and the dean didn't care. She kept no records. There was a highly regarded professor who refused to speak to any student on campus, but who was kind and courteous to students who came to his office. I remember later, during the Second World War, during a burst of hysterical efficiency, classes were held on Thanksgiving Day, and the Christmas vacation consisted of the weekend. Until recent years, Purdue had very few Negro students, for the blacks saw no future for them in engineering and agriculture, or very little opportunity. Most of the black students in the state went to Indiana University to study law and medicine and school administration. There was no black problem at the university, of course, in those days. I'd like to add a personal note that only indirectly throws some light on the university during these years. I thoroughly enjoyed my 45 years at Purdue, partly because I liked teaching, and partly because the university presidents and the heads of my department treated me well. I never asked for a favor of any kind. It wasn't granted freely and cheerfully. As the years passed, I had almost complete freedom in my choice of courses, textbooks, and scheduling. I gave the first course in the plays of Bernard Shaw in an American university. Today, there are over 100 institutions that offer
courses. What year
course
did you inaugurate the course?
I can't remember. I was asked that by the Shaw Society, and I just couldn't remember. I have to go back to my old text, my class books, which I've kept. I couldn't find out. But it was in the very early 40s, I think. I had the experience of being head of our department for 1 year. I was glad to have the experience, but had no desire to repeat it. When my last class met, I enjoyed it, but I was equally glad to have that phase of my life end, and I've had no desire to go back to my profession. In fact, I turned down 6 teaching offers soon after I retired. We all tend to look nostalgically on the past, remembering mostly the pleasant things. I have tried not to do so. To be sure, 40 and 50 years ago, the enrollment was small, and those who came, as I said a few moments ago, felt privileged to be able to do so. There was some student grumbling and dissatisfaction, of course, and occasionally a troublemaker who would be sent away. It seems to us very simple. But it's already hackneyed to point out that students now are older at 19 than students were half a century ago. They make demands, some, perhaps most, justifiable. They question whether this is the best of all possible worlds, whether this is the best of all possible universities. They want a better world, a better university, and a more rewarding life when they leave the university. Although some are shocked by the methods and certainly the appearance of many of the dissidents, some of the hope of the future lies in the discontent. And they are being listened to in a way unthinkable years ago. It is possible that the great body of questioning students is quite capable of coping with, or sometimes just ignoring, the lunatic fringe of noisy troublemakers who want to destroy our society, not improve it. I sometimes think Purdue has the most intelligent and promising student body it has ever had.
Well, I would like to go back and do some personal things now. When did you go to the University of London?
1930 and 1931.
With whom did you study there, and what was your major interest?
I studied under Allardyce Nicol, who was the great authority on 19th and early 20th century British drama, written a number of books on it. Before my second year was over, I had a chance to write a book on a late 19th century playwright. I had become acquainted with his daughter, and she offered to turn over all his papers and manuscripts.
Who was this?
It was Henry Arthur Jones.
Oh, yes.
He's almost forgotten now.
Jones Pinero. Yes.
He and Pinero and Shaw were the three great.
Yes.
In fact, more plays by Jones were performed between 1895, I think it was 1905, than any other playwright, with the possible exception of Shakespeare in England.
Not even Wilde was in there.
He didn't write as many plays. See, Wilde wrote only about 5, and Jones wrote 100, many of them very bad.
And yet you see the importance of being earnest every year, and you never see a Jones play.
No, he's completely left the theater.
Fascinating.
But I wrote a book on him, which is, as well, a book on late 19th century drama. And before I wrote it, I wrote to my dean at Purdue and said, I have a chance to write this book. Said, I complete my work at the university. Wrote back and said, write the book. I later learned all I had to do was present the book to the University of London and get my PhD degree.
But you have.
Which I never got around to doing.
You never got around to presenting
never
the book.
Got around to doing.
Well, now tell me, I'm fascinated. You have met and known some of the great literary figures of the 20th century. And, of course, you were a personal friend of the late Somerset Maugham.
Yes.
Will you tell us how you met Mr. Maugham and your relationship with him?
Well, I met him after I had I got together an anthology of modern plays. This was about 1929. I couldn't get any satisfaction from the publisher of his play, The Circle, which I wanted to include. They made it more and more difficult, and I wrote to him directly and asked him if he would give his permission, if he didn't object, give his permission in writing, and I'd give that to the publisher. He wrote back at once, a very friendly letter, and I answered. And I sent him a copy of the anthology. He sent me in return a number of his books, autographed. Then we met, finally, in New York in 1935. I told me when he was arriving, and I went down. The ship came in. I've forgotten now which one it was. And I saw him two or three times in New York. And later that summer, I was his guest in London at Garrick Club and elsewhere, and in later years I was often a guest at his villa in the south of France.
Did you assist him to arrange anything in literary memoirs? Or?
No, heavens no. No, I did do one thing though. He gave me the manuscript of his sort of autobiography, and I at his suggestion went over the punctuation, the summing up, which was a very presumptuous thing to do. But he was always very kind to me. A number of years ago, when he was 80, a New York publisher asked me to do a 80th birthday edition of A Human Bondage, which is partly autobiographical, to write the introduction for it. And I went to Europe and did that and visited him, and he answered every question that I asked him about his life that I wanted to use about the book.
To what extent is A Human Bondage autobiographical?
It's fairly autobiographical, clear up to the near the end. Mr. Maugham stammered badly, and the defect he gives Philip in the book is a club foot. Because the stammering can strike some people as amusing, and it wouldn't arouse the pathos and the pity that
the clubfoot.
Mr. Maugham studied medicine just as Philip did. He got his degree both in surgery and medicine.
Was the slattern in the Of Human Bondage a real character in his life?
The what?
The slattern, the first hero, the first one.
The Mildred?
Mildred, yes.
Yes, well, that is one of the literary secrets.
Well, and we will pass over it. I think
I know who Mildred is. In fact, I'm pretty sure I do. Yeah,
but I think one of the characters in modern literature who is all woman is the character in...
Cakes and Ale.
Rosie.
Yes, well, Rosie came from real life.
Rosie is a very human person.
And I had met Rosie. I didn't know who she was when I met her. I didn't know for a long time. When I was writing a book on Maugham, I went to see his old friend Sir Gerald Kelly, the painter. He and Maugham had been in Paris together when they were both young. Kelly was learning to paint and Maugham was trying to write. And Sir Gerald took me back in the back part of the studio where he had on file a great many canvases and a curtain in front of him. He pulled the curtain back and he pulled one out, And he said, this is Rosalie. And here was the picture described in Cakes and Ale, exactly. And I said, who was she? He said, that I can't tell you. But he said something that gave me a clue. And every next weekend, my wife and I were guests down the country in the home of a woman who turned out to be the niece of Rosie. And she told enough about the relationship between her aunt and who was a very naughty, likable woman, and Mr. Malm.
Did Rosie
fit together?
Did Rosie marry the publican and come to the United States in the end? That was just something he put in.
No, Rosie was came from a very well-known family. Her sister was a lady-in-waiting to Queen Mary, has a title.
She was a lady, a real lady then?
Well, not by birth, but she rose. There are other countries besides the United States where you can come up in the world.
Well, of course, that has been always the story of British of British titles, anyway.
And she herself married the second son of a nobleman. He didn't get the title. He was an honorable. And actual details of that, I said to Mr. Malm, I found out who Rosie is. He looked at me strangely, and he said, how did you? And I told him, through Rosie's niece, and Sir Gerald Kelly. I said, how much of it can I use in my book? He said, use anything you want, but remember the British law of libel, which is 10 times as severe as the American. And the book was to be published by Heinemann. So I had to be very cautious, change the name, but I gave the story as well as I could.
Well, that is fascinating. Did you ever meet any other of the modern British novelists and poets? Didn't you once have tea with the great poet and novelist Hardy?
Yes, yes. George Wyckoff and I were...
Now, George Wyckoff, for the tape, was in the Department of English with you.
Yes.
Here.
He has retired, and he was a colleague in the department. We went to Europe one summer and wandered around. We got to England. We were both Hardy fans at that time. We were down in Dorchester, or in Dorsetshire, and I wrote to Mrs. Hardy and asked if we could come out. A very almost brazen thing to do, but she answered politely and said, come for tea a certain day. Please do not regard it as an interview, and don't write it up as an interview later. This is and we went out, and I suppose we had 2 or 3 hours, good talk. He took us out to the stable, I remember.
What did he talk about?
He talked about country life. Talked about his years in London when he was studying architecture. He told me, I remember one thing, that he had a good friend who was a close friend of Byron, but that bridging those years, of course the man was old and Hardy was young at that time, but he had a good friend in London who had been a very close friend of, I figured out, subtracted years and so on, which is quite possible. And talked about the Galsworthys, who spent some time in the summer down in that area.
Did you ever meet Galsworthy?
Never met him. I met Priestley 2 or 3 times, and once briefly H.G. Wells, but I never met Galsworthy.
Who do you think is the most considerable novelist of the 20th century? Let's say, up to 1960 in England, English novelist.
Oh, English novelist. I wouldn't dare to say. It's
used to be the betting would be on Galsworthy.
Well, Galsworthy went into a great decline. He's come back a little because of the television version of these books are selling again. I know there's certain cults. There's a James Joyce cult, of course, and a Conrad cult. But there's so much variety among them, I would hate to say which I think is even the great. I couldn't say which I think is the greatest.
That seems to be a scholar's answer.
Well, it's an honest
did you
answer.
Ever meet or know T.S. Eliot?
No, I saw him once. I was going along Russell Square with Walter Guillemare, Jr. We were going out for lunch. Walking along, a man came out of Faber & Faber office there. And young Guillemare said, "There's Tom Eliot." Well, they didn't register me who Tom Eliot would be. And I looked, and here was a man with a rolled umbrella, not a cloud in the sky. And he'd bowler on, going along in a very stately way. It occurred to me that's the only time I'd ever seen one person who gave the impression of a procession. But I never met him. No.
I spent an evening with him once. A very charming man. Very
well,
charming.
He had some very, very close friends and admiring friends. One of them, oddly enough, was Groucho Marx, who saw him not long before Eliot's death in London. And they wrote some interesting, not altogether amusing letters, and serious letters to one another.
If you, as you have taught and read literature, have you been in close contact with American writers in English?
Oh, a few. My best friend among American writers is the playwright S.N. Behrman. And I see him when I go to New York, and he keeps threatening to come out here. Mr. Malm, by the way, visited me in Lafayette once, and he spoke to a selected group of students at the university.
Were you in the famous party with Tom Wolfe?
Oh, yes.
You were in on that?
Oh, yes.
Were you for the tape tell about it?
Yes. This was one of the two public talks that Wolfe ever gave. Yeah, I think he gave one other at Colorado. He was very nervous and uncertain as a speaker. A huge man. He mopped his brow constantly all during his talk. He made a marvelous spoonerism. He was talking about his years at Harvard and studying under Professor Baker, studying drama under Professor Baker. And he spoke of Professor Worker's Bake Shop, which is one of the pleasant spoonerism. Well, after the party, H.J. Moore heard Moore.
Let's get this down. Wasn't he paid a fee? And finally, he and several members of the Department of English took a day or two off and went to Chicago, where, shall we say, in an atmosphere more conducive to bohemian living. The party continued?
Well, yes. Before that happened, though, there was a party after his talk over at Muller's. About six or eight of us there. And Wolfe talked all night. I mean that literally. I remember some of us sat on the floor and listened to him. I never heard such talk. It came out in great cascades of language, like the writing in his novels.
Was it a good talk?
You mean the talk he gave?
No, was it
oh,
good
yes,
conversation?
Yes, it was fascinating. Much better than his
speech. Naturally, those they usually are.
Well, we talked all night, and some two or three of the bachelors in the department went with him then to Chicago as he was leaving, and they continued the party there.
Yes. That's what I meant.
Yes. And then he went on from here to the West Coast, became critically ill. They brought him back to Baltimore, where he died at Johns Hopkins. This was one of the last parties he ever went to.
Do you know people like Bill Inge among the modern playwrights?
No, I don't know. You
haven't met them?
I never met him.
Well, now let me get you back to Purdue and to Purdue personalities. What year did you attain the rank of full professor?
1937.
Then you retained it under the administration of Professor Eliot, President Eliot.
Oh, yes.
Did Eliot impress you as a person who was sincerely concerned with the humanities and with social science?
Well, I don't want you to misinterpret this, but
that's a loaded
question. He was especially concerned with any particular area of teaching out of the curriculum. He was a good administrator. He was a good builder. The university grew. I think he was the right sort of president for those years.
Yes. In other words, that he was a builder is what.
Yes, that's right. I don't think he was partial to any one part of the university, or particularly over enthusiastic about it or hostile to it. I always liked him. In his last years, he was an invalid. His home on South 7th Street. I went once a week, and we talked for about 2 hours. Great reader, clear to the end. The last time I saw him, they brought him new books from the library constantly. They saw that he was supplied with them. He had a biography and some book he tells us on the new physics, and he held it up, said, "This is the most fascinating thing I've read," which was just a short time before he died, but his interest in reading and books. He told me once, rather surprised me, that he read The New Republic, every issue from his first publication in 1916. He said a great many people don't know that. They think me rather an old fogey, but he said, "I keep up. I read The New Republic every week."
Did you know President Stone? He preceded him very well.
Well, not very well, of course, because I just once just, in his home. Yeah. Well, I think once he had a faculty tea, maybe, but a few times in his office.
But that was all.
He was a...
Of course, I know that you've known President Hubdy.
Yes.
Now, let's come down the line. You mentioned a series of deans under whom you work. Is there anyone that you'd like to reminisce about? That includes, of course, Dean Ayers and Dean Ayers' celebrated successor, Dean Ogle. Do you have any comments there that you'd like to make on the men that you've known? You knew Dean Enders and Dean Ayers and people like that.
Oh, I really never had much to do with them. I knew Dean Ayers and his wife very well. I know the Ogles. When I was acting head of the department one year, I had a great deal to do with Dean. He had his hands on the purse strings. I had to go to him for practically every dollar, extra dollar. He'd find the money somewhere, but it was a constant financial struggle.
The Department of English now has over 100, hasn't it?
No, not of full-time teachers, because it has actually fewer now than it had a few years ago because of the graduate students.
Filling in and doing this.
See, they give a master's degree in English and a doctor's degree, and these graduate students do practically all the teaching of freshmen and a good deal of sophomores. So they either 80-some, perhaps there are 6 or 7 or 8 fewer than
in other
years
words,
ago.
It's grown from 10 anyway to 8.
Oh yes. If it weren't for the graduate teachers, it'd be well over 100.
You mentioned some eminent people, but there's one man that I would like to have you reminisce about, if you would. Is a man who was as kind to me as any older man could be to a young faculty member, and that was Professor Creek. He must have been a joy and delight to work with.
Yes. Well, I've often said that he was one of the two or three best people I've ever known, using best in the old-fashioned sense of the word. He had integrity, he had courage, he had no publicity agent. No one knew of the many things that Dr. Creek did.
But he was a scholar, and he knew scholarship.
And he was kind to people. I was very, very fond of him.
Well, he was always so kind to me. See, I knew some others of your department. I met a man who I would like to have known better, a Professor Kidd, K-I-D-D.
Yeah, well, Kidd was one of the originals. You might call him eccentric, normally. He was an excellent teacher. I heard that over and over and over from students. Outside the classroom, he seemed very serious.
Very he much managed to accumulate several hundred thousand dollars by
very much
reading the stock market.
He was investing in real estate of the kind that pays well but doesn't require a great deal of money for upkeep and so on. He accumulated a good deal of money.
And then I remember a flamboyant man who was a striking personality in Professor Babcock.
Yes. He took the Shakespeare after Professor Little left. And the two were completely unlike, but they made the course one of the certainly distinctive experiences of a great many students here at Purdue. He was trained as a lawyer. Got his law degree, but he got into teaching and liked it and stayed there.
Well, you have talked earlier about the position of the English department, and let's just look at that a little. As you look over, I hate to use this, the word of the service department, how do you think our English department over the years compared with that of other English departments in the Big Ten? Obviously,
it didn't compare very well for a number of years. But I remember in the 1940s, in 1 week, a period of 1 week, two bookmen from the big New York publishing companies coming around both said the same thing. You know the Purdue English Department has one of the best reputations in the United States for publications of its staff members. But it took a long time to get there. When I was in the University of Singapore in 1964...
You taught there for a...
Oh, no. I just gave one lecture there.
One lecture.
And I was a guest to a friend of mine, an Englishman who was teaching there. But I found that Purdue was well known among all the graduate students in English at the University of Singapore because of the periodical Modern Fiction Studies. They go around carrying it almost like a Bible. They get all their bibliographies out of that.
And edited here, wasn't it?
It's edited. Still is at Purdue.
Who's the editor now?
Stafford, William Stafford.
Stafford. Let me ask something else, too, on this. As the university enlarged, grew in numbers, and the English department grew in numbers, men started to get away for a lot of their teaching from merely teaching composition. People like Professor Lowe started to make reputations in poetry and in studies of particular men, such as Arnold. Is this the kind of, is our department, say since World War II under Mr. Hubby, has it reached a stature as a good department to go to for not only scholarly work but also for graduate work?
I think so. I think so. I'm sure it is. I think the department compares very well with that of Indiana University and Illinois.
Well, we don't have the huge number of manuscripts, do we, that Illinois has. Of course, they've got the Wells papers,
they've
and they got the Thackeray papers.
More money, yes. The University of Illinois, University of Texas, a few of them that seem to be more research centers, of course. Now they have the Lilly Library at Bloomington, which Time magazine calls the best research library for scholars of literature between the two coasts. And it's only 100 miles and is easily available for students who wish to use it here. No, we don't have the original materials here.
It's interesting that someone didn't think to get the... Don't we have the original manuscripts of George Ade or of Tarkington?
Yes, we have a good many of the Indiana writers. The Indiana room full of first editions and a number of manuscripts. But not much has ever been done with them.
Yeah, it's too bad that somebody didn't get Lawrence Chambers' memoirs when he was editor of Bob's Merrill, because he published all these men. He knew them intimately. Somebody should.
I should think his letter file would.
I wonder what's happened to it.
I don't know.
Would you say that the great transition that you've seen in 45 years would be a transition from a service department to a department within a discipline?
Oh, yes.
That is what.
That is, we finally reached the point that it made no difference to us what, say, the engineering school, and it decides, after all, what courses its students should take in the humanities. It didn't make any difference if they didn't send anybody. We were going on our own. But I must say, in my elective courses, I always enjoyed the engineers. I confess something, I really enjoyed them more than the literature graduate students.
Well,
their opinions were fresher.
Yeah, they're not going to be so.
They didn't get them out of books of criticism.
Yeah, they're not going to be so absorbed with the details, the technical details.
They were interested in reading.
Yes.
Not in literature as a discipline. And most of them, they chose the course because they wanted that particular thing. They were always a delight to have in class. I enjoyed the engineers. I wish I could have had more of them.
The girls, too. And we have some very bright girls. I remember when I worked with Herbert Moore in liberal science, we had a brilliant group of girls in that liberal science curriculum, which was discontinued.
Yes, see. More, far more interesting group of girls now than years ago.
Well, they're very serious. Well, now, have we pretty well covered your life at Purdue? 45 years. An hour's conversation doesn't seem to be much.
No.
Is there something you'd like to add to it? Is there some topic that we should have brought up and haven't? About the university and the change in attitude, or obviously the university doesn't, the students, the whole milieu of the university has changed, even in the short time I've been here.
Well, I don't know what to add any more than these little things I have pointed out. I could repeat that I'm not at all pessimistic about the quality of students.
Of course,
today.
What's happened in the, as in this series of interview for the Oral History Project, I discover that the real breaking point was World War II. When we emerged from World War II, Purdue was a big university with more of a national reputation than it ever had before, and it's gone on this way. In short, President Hubney's 25 years, it seems to be the history of the transition.
Yes, there's quite a change, and you weren't here at the end of the war.
No, I wasn't. I came right
after. Well, the student was flooded with GIs who came back. And they
I was here when that happened, yes.
Well, you may remember what a really excellent classes we had. Not that they were any brighter than the students we've had before, but they were serious. They did
their
reading.
They were the best students I've ever had.
They did their reading. They prepared. And did all the things the students could always have been doing, but that hadn't always done. They were a delight to have.
They were the best students I've ever had. No question. That is as a group. What do you think of Lafayette as a community for the university? Do you think that the university is, that Lafayette is a proper community for it?
Yes, I think compared with the most university towns, I think it is. I don't think there's a hostility here between town and gown that you find in some places. Perhaps because it's in West Lafayette and separated in a way from Lafayette. I think there's a much pleasanter relationship here between university in the city than perhaps there is in Bloomington, Indiana, between Indiana
The university does dominate that community, doesn't it?
Well, it more so than here.
Yes.
The different size of the cities involved, and of course, Indiana has 30,000 students, and the population of Bloomington is something like 42,000. So out of the 72,000 in the community, 30,000 are on the campus there.
If you were going to ask a graduate student to come to Purdue and select the field in which he would be best prepared, you know, what is our outstanding specialty in English, what would you say?
Well, Nineteenth century British literature, and Shakespeare.
There's where we have our best faculty in collections.
I think so. And American literature, especially, I would say. I put that first.
American literature.
American literature. I had a student a year or two before I retired, an English boy from Leeds, University of Leeds, and he came directly from Leeds to Purdue to get a master's degree in American literature.
Is that so?
And I said, why did you come here? He said, my major professor at Leeds said that I should choose between, I forgot now, one Eastern university, Stanford, and Purdue. He didn't know why the three were, but that.
Well, I think I've talked you out.
Really?
We can go on some more, but would you? Is there anything you'd like to say?
No.
Not at this time.
No, I. May
I thank you very much, and to say that this interview, recorded on July 29, 1970, at 2001 Union Street, Lafayette, Indiana, between Professor Richard Cordell and R.B. Eccles. This interview is for the Purdue University Archives.